Okay, so yesterday we started discussing the theory of inflation. And so it's a postulate or an assumption that before the era of radiation, there was this era of very, very rapid expansion of the universe. And so this theory was originally proposed to solve the three puzzles, which I'll mention in a minute. But you know, what's happening is nicely captured by introducing this Kommewing Hubble radius. And so this Kommewing Hubble radius, R hat, is given by 1 over the scale factor and the Hubble parameter. And so if we have to have a rapid expansion of the universe, then this thing actually is rapidly decreasing. So this Hubble radius is shrinking like crazy. And the physical meaning of this radius is that it tells you which parts of the universe are in causal contact at that time. And it tells you, you know, whether the particle could communicate with another particle in nearby future, meaning in Hubble's time. And so the best picture to have in mind about the inflation is the one which I tried to draw in the embedding diagram. So if this is the origin, and so if before the inflation, the Hubble radius was really, really large, so our initial, then after the inflation, actually this shrank very, 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 very small. And so this is the effect of inflation. So after the inflation, only very, very small part of the universe was actually in causal contact. And so this is the inflation part. And then after that, the normal era of radiation and normal matter started. And this Hubble radius again starts expanding. This is the normal matter. And so today we have Hubble's radius something like here. And as long as this R0 hat is smaller, approximately than Ri hat, then actually you can solve all the puzzles that are to be solved. So now you characterize this shrinking of the Hubble's radius by the e-fold number. So you define the e-fold number n to be ri hat over rf hat. And for the puzzles to be solved, I told you probably yesterday 60. So I have 50, so now I'll tell you 60, it doesn't matter. Typically people consider something between 40 and 80. So anyway, so let's how I'll use today 60. So that means that in that very, very, you know, instant of time when the inflation took place, the universe exponentially increased, you know, e to the 60 times. And so in order this to happen, we had two kinematic conditions. And so one of them, we introduced a small parameter epsilon, which was given by minus h dot over h square. And the first condition is that this parameter is much, much smaller than 1. And then there is another parameter eta, which is given by epsilon dot over h epsilon. And the other condition is that if you take absolute value over here, then again, this is much, much smaller than 1. The physical meaning of the first condition is really that we have rapidly shrinking Hubble's radius. So rapidly shrinking R hat. And the meaning of the second one is that the inflation lasts sufficiently long. Inflation lasts long enough so that actually you can get those 60 e-folds. So if the second condition were not satisfied, then you would get less e-folds. So the inflation would start, the Hubble radius would be shrinking rapidly, but it wouldn't last long enough. It would just terminate in a short time. Okay. So now this is the kinematics of inflation. And so we also asked the question, what kind of matter drives inflation? So matter driving inflation and so what I derived yesterday at the very end of our lecture is that such matter has to have the equation of state, which is this one. So the density plus 3 times pressure is smaller than 0. Or in other words, that the ratio of density and pressure is actually smaller than 1 over 3. And then I told you that this violates some energy condition, so strong energy condition. Energy condition, which for a classical relativist might be a bordering fact, but of course people doing cosmology don't really care. By the way, a cosmological constant has W equals to minus 1, so that's even violating more conditions and stuff like that. So by the way, these energy conditions, so you might think, so these tell you, you know, how the matter should behave. They tell you that the energy density of the matter has to be positive. They tell you that matter cannot travel faster than light and stuff like that. And so you might be thinking, because it's the properties of the matter, then you can derive it from, you know, so matter is described by quantum field theory. So you might be thinking, okay, there must be something in quantum field theory which tells you these conditions have to be true. Okay? So now everything you need to know about quantum field theory is, of course, in Weinberg's book. So now you open Weinberg's book and search for the chapter on energy conditions. And then you search and search, and in the end you find that there is none. Okay? That's, of course, a proof that energy conditions do not follow from quantum field theory. Because if they did, Weinberg would put the proof there. Okay? So so this actually tells you that really the energy conditions are not really a property of matter, but rather they are something like how the matter interacts with this gravitational field. So there's something which you really need, which should be coming sort of from gravity side. And it's the classical assumptions which typically people impose that, you know, this is reasonable, but maybe actually this is not true. So maybe the energy conditions actually are not that important as people think. Certainly, you know, if you assume some energy conditions, you can derive some famous theorems in general relativity, the singularity theorems and stuff like that. The fact that the horizon of the black hole is always increasing. But all these things are, you know, based on the classical intuition, based on the fact that you classically impose these energy conditions, but they may not be true. Okay? So really, this is not a big deal as viewed by people doing modern physics. Okay? So let me just stress at the end that, so this is the idea of inflation, and if you want, this is all you need to know about inflation. Okay? And you see that if I describe it in this way, then this is just a framework. In other words, it's not one concrete theory, but rather it's just, yeah, in order to describe the puzzles, in order to solve, you know, I didn't mention the puzzles, but it's the monopole puzzle and the horizon puzzle and stuff like that, then all I need is these things here. Okay? So now, of course, concrete realization of this framework will give you the actual theory, one theory of inflation, and there is many, many theories of inflation. Okay? So now let me discuss and just give you some buzzwords which you may hear about this. So the physics of inflation or if you want, you know, concrete theories, concrete theories. So the simplest case where you can actually satisfy these kinematic requirements is basically the cosmological constant. So the first possibility is false vacuum inflation. Or what I mean by this is that actually we have constant energy density driving the inflation. And this is something like lambda, but actually the value of that would be bigger than lambda observed today. And so you know when you solved in your second tutorial that if you just impose the FRW spacetime with a constant energy density, with a cosmological constant, then you necessarily get Desiter, expanding Desiter universe. So actually this leads to expanding Desiter universe. And the metric is given by minus dt squared. So I'll just write it for, let's say, k equal to 0. But you know that in principle, you can slice your Desiter space in different ways, and you can get different case. You can get k equal to minus 1 if you slice it this weird way, the hyperboloid. You get k equal to 0 if you slice it this way. And then you get k equal to plus 1 if you slice it that way. That's what you discussed in your tutorial. So it's minus dt squared plus 2ht, and then dxi square, dx1 plus dx2 plus dx3 square, where this h is just a constant. So this is the metric which you derived in the tutorial. So now you can use this metric and you can calculate whether your kinematic conditions are satisfied. And of course, if h is equal to a constant, then its time derivative is simply 0. So epsilon is equal to 0. But derivative of 0 is still 0. So also eta is equal to 0. So the both conditions are satisfied. So 0 is definitely smaller than 1. So this is fine. So the kinematic conditions work. So now what is the problem with this type of concrete theory of inflation is, well, the problem is that classically such an inflation never ends. So you model this cosmological constant by saying, well, I have some potential, and then I'm sitting in some local minimum of that potential. But of course, if you are sitting in the local minimum of that potential, then classically you cannot get outside of that minimum. So classically, such inflation never ends. And so the question is how you would really start the whole Big Bang as we know it, how you would start the radiation era. So quantum mechanically, you can tunnel from one local minimum to maybe some lower minimum or whatever. And so this was a model of this was discussed in Ruth's course. So remember in the last lecture, she had this expanding bubble or something like that, and she had one lambda inside, and then she had the bubble, and then she had another lambda outside. So of course that bubble is a problem, because the bubble is formed somewhere, somewhere in the universe, and then it starts expanding, right? And as it expands, it destroys everything on its way. So actually, if you had some structure formations or something like that, then actually this bubble would destroy that, and that's why this actually rules out what we observe. So can tunnel, but does not correspond to universe as we know it. It's we know it. Now I'm like, I don't know, Japanese writing from down up. okay, so. by the way, you know, this tunneling probability that you tunnel from one minimum to maybe a global one is teeny tiny. But if you really consider just, you know, lambda inside and lambda outside, but what actually Ruth calculated recently is that once you start putting some inhomogeneities inside or outside, then the probability increases rapidly. So what she considered in her papers is that she put a black hole. And once you put a black hole, actually the probability increases many, many times. So we know that in our universe we have some black holes, at least one. And if you have at least one, the probability is much, much higher. So if at this point this was the true theory and we were not in the global minimum, but we were in the local one, then actually we are in big trouble because you have black holes and the probability of, you know, tunneling to a smaller one would be quite high. And so we can read about these things in Ruth's papers if you want. Okay, so that's one type of inflation. So now holy grail of inflation is this slow roll inflation. And we'll discuss that a little bit today. And so this is simply driven by a single scalar field, So basically, you are saying that the content of the universe in the inflation era was just one simple scalar. And this is called inflaton. And so we will discuss this a little bit more in detail today. But you have also other possibilities. You have hybrid inflation. And then you have, let's say, DBI inflation. And you have also gauge field inflation. So there's many, many models. So what hybrid inflation is that, so the inflation has two problems. So why it started? What are the initial conditions which are actually causing that the inflation starts, and how it ended? So when once the inflation is there, so for example here you have really, really big trouble how to exit the era of inflation. Classically you can't, right? So these are the two problems, and so hybrid inflation is trying to address the second one. So it's saying basically instead of one scalar field, I will have two scalar fields. And the other one basically causes, well, the one is driving the inflation, it's the really dominant thing, and the other one decides, okay, we have had enough of inflation, so now we actually do something with the scalar field so that the inflation stops. And it's a similar mechanism to Higgs mechanism or whatever, where actually, you know, one interacts with the other and tells that it should be the end of inflation. Then you have, you know, you can add more fields. Typically, string theory has 300 fields or something like that. You can have fields which have actually wrong sign of kinetic term, which is this type of inflation. You can also consider not scalar field driving inflation, but you can consider, I don't know, gauge field driving inflation. Dirac Born Infeld. So the action. It's Dirac Born and Infeld. Okay, everybody knows Dirac. Everybody knows Born, and Infeld was a student of Einstein, I think. So basically, it's type of the action they proposed. Originally, this was an action for electromagnetism, but now actually this action appears now everywhere, and so people use it in string theory, people use it in cosmology, people use it for many other things. So these things will be also discussed, I hope, in the exploration course. So maybe you can actually learn more about these various possibilities of inflation. Okay, I'll not go into those details, but I'll really discuss the holy grail of inflation, which is the slow roll inflation. So slow roll. And so the beauty about this one is that it sort of worked until very recently with the simplest possible potential you can imagine. So now you just consider gravity plus a scalar field with some potential. So d4x square root of g, and then r 16 pi g, and then minus 1 half d phi square. And then also the potential for the scalar field. So phi is your inflaton here. And so this is the corresponding action. This is the corresponding matter content during the inflation era. Okay. So now if you consider this action here, then of course you vary the action with respect to the scalar field. And you find the corresponding equation of motion. So lambda square on phi minus v prime of phi. So v prime is dv over d phi is equal to 0. Of course, if I choose v equal to m square phi square, this just gives me massive Klein-Gordon equation. If there's no potential, it's just massless Klein. It's the wave equation. Okay, so that's what the equation of motion for the scalar field. You can also write down the Einstein equations. So now you vary with respect to g mu nu, and you get the Einstein equations with the corresponding t mu nu. So t mu nu of the scalar field. So now I'll write a formula. I don't remember if this is the formula Roos wrote down. Is this the one, or she wrote something else? Maybe. So if you look at this formula here, it's quite tricky. You know that t mu nu has to be a tensor, but obviously the square root of determinant is not, right? So if this is not a tensor, L here is not a tensor. So L here is actually a tensor density. So if I'm looking at the action, so this thing is a tensor, and all these things are tensors. But the tensor density, which is meant over there, the L, is you just split these two into d4x and square root of g, and you take the square root of g and add it to your Lagrangian. So this is what is L. So it's square root of g times this part. Okay? And so, very good. So now you have formula d mu phi, d nu phi, and then minus 1 half g mu nu d phi square, and then minus g mu nu v of phi. Okay, so if you do the variation of that Lagrangian density, then this is your t mu nu. So now if you look at this, this almost looks like a t mu nu of the perfect fluid. So I certainly have g mu nu times something. So if I had u mu u nu of the fluid times something else, this would be a perfect fluid. So now we compare this, with t mu nu of the perfect fluid, which is rho plus p times u mu u nu plus p g mu nu. And we also know that the fluid is normalized. So the velocity of the fluid is u squared is minus 1. OK, so now looking at the term which is multiplying g mu nu, so I have p here, and I have this minus 1 half d phi square and minus v. OK, so you can identify that the pressure is actually minus 1 half d phi square minus v. Then you know that the velocity somehow, so I have u mu u nu, so this must be related to this d mu phi d nu phi. And u square must be equal to minus 1. So there is no surprise that u mu is just normalized d mu phi. And the normalization is this one minus d phi square. Okay, so this is your four velocity. And then you compare with whatever. So then you have to have rho plus p in front of that. But you already know what p is, so you can infer what rho is. And so rho is just minus 1/2 d phi square plus v. Okay, so that's the difference between pressure and density. So of course, density has the sum of the energies, and the pressure has minus v instead. Okay, so you can formally understand p mu nu of the scale field as actually t mu nu of perfect fluid with these characteristics. So let's push this analogy even further. And so you can write down this parameter w, which is just p over rho. And of course, it's just minus 1/2 d phi square minus v divided by -1/2 d phi square plus v. Okay, so the scalar field has this equation of state. So now we better make it constant. To make it constant, you consider two different limits. So the limit of Bigley field which I mean that the potential is negligible with respect to the kinetic term, so the field is actually moving like crazy. So d phi square is much, much bigger than v. So that's my condition for Bigley field. If that is true, I can neglect v both in numerator and denominator. And I'm just getting that w is equal to 1. This is a new equation of state. You haven't seen that equation of state before. So I remind you the formula when we had w equal to constant, we solved one of the Friedmann equations, and we found that the energy density goes like e to minus 3, 1 plus w. So obviously now w is plus 1, so the density goes like 8 to the 6 in the denominator. So that's how the energy density behaves, is the scale factor. And it's, as I said, it's a new kind of matter which we haven't considered yet. And we will not consider it. But it's actually a very useful matter. And this is how the inhomogeneities in the universe actually behave. It's precisely this fall of 1 over 8 to the 6. It's characteristic for structure formation. And if you start, you know, discussing inhomogeneities in the universe, so inhomogeneities in the universe. And so that would be very, very important. So you can model these inhomogeneities by simply a scalar field which obeys this equation here. So we will not discuss that. And the second possibility, which is typically discussed, is the smooth field, meaning the kinetic energy is negligible. So v is now much bigger than d phi square. And if that is true, then you have you neglect d phi square up and down, and then you have w equals to minus 1. Which we know it's like a cosmological constant. Okay? So this gives rho equals to constant. And so it sort of mimics lambda. And so certainly w equals to minus 1 satisfy my condition of this thing here. And so this is a good candidate for inflation. questions. Okay. So now let's really consider this scalar field and let's use it for inflation. But we still assume that we are still, that the universe during the inflation is still homogeneous and isotropic. Okay, so we still still assume FRW spacetime, so homogeneity and isotropy, even during inflation. I don't know what would happen if you didn't. But anyway, so you still assume that FRW space is true, and you know, we just write it down for this matter content. And then it's easy to convince yourself that the scalar field cannot be spatially dependent, right? So if I move somewhere else, and if it were spatially dependent, this would be a disaster. So from here, it follows that the scalar field, which you will be considering in inflation, is just a function of time, not of space. Okay. And so if this is true, then you just have to write down your equation of motion, and then you have to write down your Einstein equations with this matter content where phi depends only on t. Okay, so then we get the equations of motion, so like Friedmann equations or equations of motion for inflation with this matter content. And so one of them is just the Friedmann equation. So it was h squared equals to 8 pi g over 3 times rho. So now rho is given somewhere here. It's minus 1 half d phi squared plus v. So now let me just write it. So I'll put this 8 pi g into the left-hand side. So 3 m Planck squared. 8 square is the energy density. It's minus 1 half d phi square plus v. But now phi depends only on t. It doesn't depend on space. So this becomes plus phi dot square. So it's 1 half phi dot square plus v. Okay, so that's basically the Friedmann equation as you know it. Just plugging that row. And so the second equation will be, the equation of motion for the scalar field. So nabla phi square minus v prime equals to 0. So now you have to write this covariant nabla square for FRW spacetime. Right? So there will be some extra factor. And so what it is that phi double dot plus 3h phi dot, so that's basically nabla square, and then plus e prime equals to 0. So these are the two equations which describe your universe with the scalar field, which is only time dependent. Okay, so what we are really doing is that we are building one concrete example of how to actually meet all the criteria which we imposed on the inflation, and it's just through the scalar field. So now you have to impose that really we do have inflation. So we have these two kinematic conditions are satisfied. So this is what you have to impose. And so epsilon, which is minus h dot over h square, so now you have to play with these equations. You can differentiate them. You can do other things. And so you can find what h dot is. And then you can read h squared is this thing here. So anyway, what you find is this is 1 half phi dot square divided by m Planck square, m Planck square h square. Okay, so these equations give you what h dot is. You plug it here, you find this is epsilon. So now if you look at this thing here, The first term is just the kinetic energy. Okay? So this is something like rho of kinetic energy. And the term in the bottom is, through this equation, the total energy contained in the field. So this is like rho kinetic over rho total. And the requirement is that this is much, much smaller than 1. So in other words, actually, the field is not moving a lot. So it must be the smooth field. Okay. So we have this thing. The rho kinetic must be much, much smaller than the total energy contained in the scalar field, and we have slow rho inflation. So the scalar field is not changing very quickly. So the second condition, eta, which is epsilon dot over epsilon h. So now, again, if you calculate what it is, you find that this is equal to 2 epsilon minus delta, where delta is some new parameter. Delta is minus phi double dot over h phi dot. And then you again require that the absolute value of this eta is much more than 1. Well, if this must be much smaller than 1, and epsilon is much smaller than 1, delta also has to be much smaller than 1. So you are getting a new condition, and which is this one, phi double dot over h phi dot is much smaller than 1. So that's another condition on the scalar field which you have to have satisfied in order this to describe inflation. Okay. So we have to condition that one and this one. So by the way, if these conditions are satisfied, so what I'm saying is that phi double dot is smaller than h phi dot. Okay. So now if you look at the second equation, what it means is that I can neglect the first term there. Okay. So now my equations of motion as a result of this thing, so equation of motion actually gets simplified. So the second equation, I neglect just phi double dot. So it's just 3 h phi dot plus v prime equals to 0. So that's my second equation. And in the first equation, I'm using that this epsilon is much smaller than 1. And so actually phi dot square is smaller than h square, m Planck square h square. So I'm neglecting again the first term on the right hand side. And so I'll have that 3 m Planck square h square equals 2b. And so these are the simplified equations governing the scalar field as long as you are in the inflation. Okay. So we see that this is fine. So now, of course, you would like to build one concrete theory of inflation. So we'd really like to find, you know, what kind of potential I can put there so that all these conditions are satisfied. Okay, so you would like to design really the theory. So I have to consider, so if I design this potential, can it actually give me the right inflation or something like that? And for that, it's actually useful to rewrite these conditions. Epsilon and delta and whatever, it's useful to rewrite them in terms of the potential, and equally it's important to rewrite how many e-folds I can get given the potential of the scalar field. Okay, and so doing that, so designing the right potential or the conditions on the potential. If you want, right potential. So I first rewrite these conditions on really on V, and then you can show that you can define a new parameter which now depends on this potential V, but it's actually the old epsilon as we used it before. But in terms of V, it can be written as M Planck square and divided by 2 V prime over V square. And then this must be smaller than 1. I'll show that in a minute. And then you have another thing, another parameter eta V, which is not, unfortunately, the old eta. It's cheating. So the old eta here is 2 times epsilon minus delta. So now I'm defining eta with V, which is epsilon plus delta. So anyway, so this is given by M Planck square V double prime over V. And again, the condition is that the absolute value of this has to be smaller than 1. OK, so these are the conditions. Given the potential, what I have to actually, how do I design my potential so that these conditions are true? Let me just prove the first one. And the second one is very simple. So the first one is that if I have, if I write this as an equation 1, and if I write that as equation 2, and I am missing h square here, so 3m Planck square h square is equal to v. So now if you take equation 1 and square it, well, I'll put v prime on the right-hand side, and then I square it. So 1 square divided by 2 square. So the left-hand side square is 9 h square phi dot square. And the left-hand side square of the second equation is 9 m Planck square, 9 m Planck 4 h4, whereas the right hand sides are just v prime square divided by v square. But if you cancel some of these h, so h square, so now this becomes square, 9 cancels, and whatever, then you find that this is just phi dot square over h square. And this is how epsilon is defined somewhere. So it's minus 1/2 phi dot square m Planck square h square. So what this really is 2 epsilon over m Planck square. And so if you look at this thing here, it's precisely what I'm writing here. And similarly, you would prove the second equation. Does it make sense? All right. So really, I have these conditions on the potential, if you want to write down the explicit example of a potential. And also, if you are interested in how many e-faults you can get from the potential, and I'll show you how to calculate that using some small approximation, just the ballpark, right? So are we going to get n equal to 60 or not? So given v, how many e-faults we can get, or can it support? Okay. So let's calculate it. So n, well, we had e to the n is ri over rf. So n is logarithm of ri hat over rf hat. So that's our definition. So now r hat is 1 over ah. Okay, so this is equal to a logarithm of a final, h final, a initial, h initial. So now the approximation comes in. So we know that during the inflation, actually, because you have sort of exponential expansion of the universe, then at some point, you in the middle of inflation, you certainly behave almost like you are in the Sitter space. Okay, so I'll be approximating that actually h is not changing too much. So hf will be approximately equal to hi, which is certainly true in the Sitter expansion. H is constant there. So anyway, so I'll approximate this is a logarithm of af over ai. Certainly the scale factor is changing like crazy, but the Hubble expansion rate is not. Okay, so I'll be doing this approximation. And so this is trivially rewritten as AI a final as D log of A, just a trivial identity. And again, trivial identity, you know how H, okay, so you divide by DT and you multiply by DT, and you know that A dot over A is H, so this can be written as an integral from t initial to t final of h dt. And then you write dt as dt over d phi d phi. And so it will be integral from phi initial to phi final. So now you're assuming that, of course, I can map uniquely, is a one-to-one mapping between t and phi. Right, the value of phi and the time it elapsed. But anyways, h over phi dot d phi, it's just dividing by phi and multiplying by phi. Okay. And then I'll be using the equation 1. So you know how to connect phi dot with v prime. So now, equation 1 here, and this is equal to minus 3 phi initial, phi final, h square divided by v prime d phi. Okay, it's just I used the equation 1. And of course, you also have to use 2. So finally, let's use 2. So instead of h squared, I'll just write v. So now equation 2. And then you are finding this is equal to 1 over m Planck square. And then integral from phi initial, phi final, v over v prime, d phi. OK, so given the potential v, I can calculate what v over v prime is. I can calculate this integral, and the result will depend on, you know, phi f and phi I, and that tells me how many e-folds I get. Okay, so I will typically want these 60 e-folds, and so that tells me how b has to look like, and how phi I and phi f actually have to be, what is the relation between them. Okay, so now what you typically have, so typical potential, which satisfies all the criteria, looks like this. So this is my v of phi, and this is my phi. And so you start with something almost flat, and so it's all, as long as it is almost flat, it's going down a little bit. But so you can think about, like, I have a ball here slowly rolling down the hill. And so that's precisely the inflation. So inflation up to here. Once I pick up lots of kinetic energy, I violate the conditions, and so I have no longer inflation. So once, you know, the slope is really getting down, so that's the end of inflation. And then you assume that there's a minimum here of the potential, and then the potential perhaps go up again. So now at the bottom, of course, you have the highest kinetic energy here. And then it is assumed that this kinetic energy of the scalar field actually is somehow transferred so that you actually can pop out all the standard particle, standard model particles out of the scalar field, and that everything gets actually heated by the energy of the scalar field. Okay, so this era, when actually the scalar field has really huge kinetic energy, is something which is called reheating. And so during the inflation, the matter content of the universe is stored in the scalar field. And somehow here, at the end of the inflation, you actually, you know, born all these particles in the standard model. And you have to transfer the energy of the scalar field to these particles. And your hot Big Bang actually starts. Yes.
So in this framework, today we still have this scalar field, which is just like doing nothing.
Exactly. You would still have the scalar field, if inflation, if this theory of inflation is right. But of course, the scalar field is typically very, very massive, so that's why you don't excite it. That's why you don't really. So this scalar field here, we'll be talking about the masses of M Planck, a little bit smaller than M Planck. So, but of course, the scalar field would still be here. Yes. Other questions? Okay, so that's the typical potential. I have 5 minutes, which is great. So the most standard example, the canonical example of slow roll inflation was simply the potential m square phi square. So no potential, non-interacting scalar field, just with the mass m. And it's surprising, and it was, that this scalar field sort of does very good job until very recently, where it was observationally ruled out. Okay. So, but you know, just one single scalar field with one parameter, its mass, can actually produce you everything theoretically which you want here. But observationally, it's been ruled out recently. And so people now, instead of considering, so Holy Grail is V equals to 1/2 m phi square, m square phi square. But unfortunately, is being ruled out now. Well, it's supposed to be a skull, but it's not really. It looks like a pumpkin. Okay. So now, people really doing this inflation, they can compare whatever the prediction is with whatever, typically what you are getting from CMB and stuff like that, with various potentials. So people have the factory and they try various potentials. And then, they can correlate this. And so it's now disfavored. So m square phi square is disfavored. So people play with very weird things now, like phi. Okay, so square root of phi or something like really, really, really weird. Of course, this would be very nice if it worked. So anyway, so let me just give you what this gives you. So epsilon v, in this case, where is it? So epsilon v is just v prime over v square, m Planck square over 2. And you require that this is much more than 1. And similar, eta v is just v double prime. two derivatives over V. So in this case, you find that they are both equal for that potential, and you find that this is M Planck square over phi square. And the requirement is both of them are smaller than one. So that's our conditions, which we impose on the potential. Okay. So what it means is that if this is true, then phi is actually much bigger than M Planck. So the value of phi is actually super Planckian. So this is large field inflation model. Okay, so for some people this is already a problem. Yeah, I have to have scalar field which is bigger than the Planck mass. But the truth is that this is not really a problem. What would be the problem if the energy density of the scalar field was bigger than the Planck density? Okay, so to trust the theory. We want that the density of the energy density of this field, which is like m squared phi square, is actually much smaller than m Planck to the 4, which is the Planck density. Okay, so this is the Planck density here. So it's not really the value of the field, but rather its density, Planck density. So we require to have slow roll inflation, we require that phi is much bigger than m Planck, but m squared phi square is much, much smaller than m Planck to the 4, is that you don't really have a problem. So phi is actually much, much smaller than m Planck square over m. And so we have a window, m Planck. So this is our regime where we would get, we can still trust the theory, but you would get slow roll inflation. So that's fine. So in other words, this tells you that actually M Planck is much, much bigger than the mass of the scalar field. And this is a hierarchy problem. So similar, you know, why Higgs mass is much more than the Planck mass or whatever. Okay, anyway, so you are concluding that this is true. So now we can calculate the number of E folds, which we did here. So you have V over V prime, so V goes like phi square, V prime goes like phi. So the integral goes like phi d phi gives you phi square. So n is 1 over 4 m Planck square phi initial square minus phi final square. OK, so now we want this to be at least 60 so that actually it solves the problems. And so you can do that. So you have all these constraints. So you have these constraints that phi is bigger than m Planck, but also m Planck is bigger than the mass. But you also want that the number of E folds is 60. And that tells you what the phi initial and phi final have to be. And so what you would find is that, so let's say impose. So for example, I can solve everything here by saying that phi initial is something like 10 times m Planck. Well, 10 times, it's 10 times bigger than m Planck, so it's much, much bigger than m Planck. Phi final is 1 over 10. Again, that's, you know, come much, much, much smaller. M Planck square and m. And then imposing n equals to 60 tells you that m Planck over M is something like 60. Okay, so really what you found that you can satisfy all the conditions if the mass of the scalar field is 60 times smaller than M Planck. Okay, so that's why people were very excited about it, is that, yeah, you can just use this very, very simple model predicting that the mass of the scalar field is, I don't know, 60, 50, or whatever, times smaller than the M Planck. You know, all theoretical things seem to be working very well. But as I said, it is unfortunately it's ruled out observationally. Now disfavored. And so, for example, if you are interested in inflation or cosmology, Gong is actually one of the people who play with this single field slow roll inflation, and in actually designing what the V has to be so that actually it fits the observational data. So if you are interested in this, talk to Gong. So to conclude, you know, inflation seems to be solving all three puzzles, the horizon puzzle, the monopole puzzle, and whatever. It is a framework. And you know, you have to build a concrete theory how to satisfy that framework. It seems that the slow roll inflation, the single field, is actually still possible, but it's not with the simplest potential you can think about, and you have to go to something more unnatural, something more complicated. But as I said, there are many other models of inflation, and so you will discuss some of them in the exploration course. So now the problem is that how, and so this is problem with every theory of inflation, so how inflation started. So in other words, is it really natural for inflation to start? What are the initial conditions for inflation? And is there a driving mechanism which tells you no matter with what I start, do I actually get inflation out of there? And so this is, for example, discussed in paper by Brandenberger. And this is 1601, 019, 18. And so he's the famous cosmologist in McGill, I hope. And so read that paper, how natural you get inflation out of something. Is there an attractor mechanism which drives you to inflation? And another problem, so these are basically problems and how it ended. Why there is no eternal inflation, like in the case of cosmological constant? What is the driving mechanism? How actually, you know, you tell the field, yeah, the inflation actually has to stop. And so this is the problem of reheating. How you produce the standard model particles out of the scalar field, how you transfer the energy of the scalar field to these standard model particles, and how the hot Big Bang actually starts. Okay, and so this is, of course, still active research. So, questions? Yeah?
Can you explain how to get M again?
How to get M?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't explain anything. So, well, are you asking about this? So this just comes from the calculation. So now, if you're asking how to get N equal to 60, so the statement is, if you are to really resolve the horizon puzzle, the flatness puzzle, and other things, you need lots of e-folds. And actually, you can estimate how many by really solving these puzzles. And then you will find that it's something between 40 and 80 or something like that. So I took the average value, let's say 60. And you will show it in your tutorial or homework or something like that. So don't worry, you will see where this 60 comes from.
Yeah, but I think if you integrate that formula, you will get phi f squared minus phi square, right?
phi f squared. Maybe I just made a mistake there. Is that, or maybe I lost the minus sign somewhere.
Yeah, minus sign in front of that formula, right?
There should be minus sign there. Okay, thanks. Other questions? All right. Well, thank you so much. See you in the afternoon.